Most of us have a general idea of what people are talking about when they discuss farm subsidies, but don't know how to make sense of the complexities of either the subsidies themselves or the history and politics behind them. Why, for example, should so many farmers receive this money when food prices are soaring as they are now? Well, joining me for today's edition of Please Explain is Dan Morgan. He has been an investigative reporter and editor with the Washington Post for over 40 years. He's written extensively about agriculture and the politics of agriculture, and he was co-author of Harvesting Cash, a year-long investigative series, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism in 2007. And soon to join us is Catherine Richard, the agricultural reporter at the Congressional Quarterly. But let's begin with you, Dan. Just to give my audience a sense of the scale we're talking about, how much is spent each year on farm subsidies?
Well, about the USDA says about we're going to probably spend about $17 or $18 billion a year on subsidies that just go to farmers. You know, there's a lot of more money spent on agricultural programs, but the ones that just go to farmers, $17 or $18 billion.
And how is that broken down? Are there categories that we'll all recognize or have heard about? For example, does it include drought relief? Does it cover livestock farming as well as subsidies for crops?
It does cover drought relief. It covers what they call disaster payments. But the big two numbers in this are the subsidy that the government provides for farmers to buy crop insurance, which is very hefty. And then there's something called direct payments, about over $5 billion a year, which go to farmers willy-nilly, whether or not they grow a crop or not. And whether or not prices are high, low, or no matter what drought conditions are, it's a form of income support for farmers. It was created in 1996 in a farm bill that was passed then.
Catherine joins us now. I don't know if you've heard what we've just been talking about, Catherine.
Just catching the tail end there.
But that $5 billion that just goes to farmers for the heck of it, what's the rationale behind something like that? $5 billion is a lot of money.
Well, the direct payment, I think you're referring to direct payments, yes? If that's what you all were discussing when I came on the line, I mean, these are payments that have existed since 1996, and the idea in 1996 is that crop prices were really good, and they wanted to create a bill that would essentially transition farmers off of those payments. What happened is that prices actually dropped in 2000 around that time, and farmers were desperate for support, so when the 2002 bill was written again, those payments essentially were put back into place and have been, you know, around essentially since then.
And they're just permanent? We can't get rid of them?
Oh, well, no. I mean, Congress could have decided to cut them this year, but the political pressure to do or not to do that is enormous.
Well, we'll get to that in a moment. But what about farm subsidies in the context of other government spending on education, for example? How do they compare?
Well, I don't have a specific number to give, but I would say that it's substantially less than what we might be spending on Medicare or Medicaid, education, and if you look at how much we're spending on the war in Iraq too, it's certainly quite a bit less than
but
that.
But I understand it's about half of what we spend on education
sure.
every year. That still is a huge amount, especially when we're talking about a country that believes in the free enterprise system.
Mm-hmm.
Dan, weren't farm subsidies initiated during the Depression? Can you tell us a bit about the original reasoning behind those farm subsidy programs?
Yes, they were initiated in the Great Depression afterwards, the Dust Bowl and all that. The reason really was to put income in the hands of farmers, to put money in the hands of farmers, so that they could sort of revive the rural economy, which had been suffering terribly. They wanted to create purchasing power in rural areas.
So we're talking about small family farms.
Yes, you had at that point there were over 6 million farms in this country, and large families lived on farms. You had a large hunk of the population that lived on farms, and so it was terribly important to sort of create economic recovery starting in rural areas, and that's what it was all about at that time.
And mostly the staple crops were being subsidized.
Yes, then and now. These subsidies go then and go now to sort of a handful of major staple crops: cotton, rice, wheat, cotton, corn, soybeans, and things like that. They don't go to there's no subsidies of this kind for people who raise livestock, for people who raise fruits and vegetables.
Does it matter whether you're doing organic farming and whether you're doing heirloom tomatoes, or are we just talking about your standard barley, cotton, corn, wheat, et cetera?
Well, pretty much the standard cotton, barley, wheat. Although there are some organic farmers of those crops now, so it could be, they could be organic.
Catherine, you suggested that the reason this we're still giving billions of dollars to farmers, even at a time when grain prices and food prices generally have been climbing, is because of political pressure?
Well, I think there are really two things at play. First of all, I believe that what happened in 1996 after the so-called Freedom to Farm Bill was written, where they tried to phase out subsidies and then crop prices dropped, really, really scared farmers, you know? And so I think that there's sort of a precedent there that even though crop prices are really good, we don't know what could happen. So that's certainly an argument you hear quite a bit as the lawmakers have been writing this bill. At the same time, there are... one thing to understand about farming politics is that it's very regional and it's not partisan most of the time. So what you see are corn farmers, for example, who work in the Midwest where farms are mid to large sized, and they're doing really well right now because of ethanol. They actually wanted to really restructure the way farm subsidies are given out. There's a complicated provision in the farm bill that reflects that, but it's not quite what they were after. And it potentially could have saved quite a bit of money. Now, down in the South, though, you're looking at farmers who have very, very huge operations. They generally grow cotton and rice, which just by the way they grow and the way they have to be irrigated are quite a bit more expensive to grow. So farmers down there rely on these subsidies quite a bit more. So you put, Southern senators and representatives in a room and you pit them against the Midwestern lawmakers, what you see are, is a lot of compromise. They had to reach somewhere between what farmers in the Plain States and in the Midwest want versus what farmers in the South want versus what farmers in New York State want versus what farmers out in California want.
Well, looking over the top 10 states, mm-hmm. Texas receives the most. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, California, which most of us think of as the great supplier of farming products, is 10th. It's behind Iowa, it's behind Nebraska, Minnesota, Kansas, Arkansas, North Dakota, which is a tiny state, Indiana. Mm-hmm. So does that mean that its people in Congress have less clout?
Well, the reason for the California being low is that they tend to grow non-subsidized crops. They do grow some cotton and wheat and probably even a little corn, but they're primarily vegetables and fruits, and they don't get subsidies per se. Let me just throw in a point on what Catherine was saying to expand it a little bit. Yes, there's a lot of politics that goes on between the North and the South, the regions, the crops, and so on, but there's a tremendous amount of politics outside the crops in the Farm Bill, and one of the reasons these subsidies go on year after year is that the Farm Bill also includes funding for nutrition programs, food stamps, and so on, and it also includes funding for conservation programs, research, energy, so that deals are made.
So is that why people, legislators from states like New York, which are not in the top of this, are still willing to vote for farm bills because they're going to get some other part of this action?
They'll get most of it.
Yeah.
The farm, the farm part of what is now what is now pending in Congress is a $300 billion five-year bill. The lion's share of that is going to go to nutrition programs, the food stamp program. So they have a huge stake in getting the farm bill through, particularly this year when the Democrats in Congress have made sure that there are the increased funds for food stamps and for urban programs that benefit nutrition low-income families. So that's the politics of it. It gets very complicated.
Well, yeah, Dan makes a really good point. I just want to add to that. You know, I think the statistic that some of the senators who gave a press conference on this bill yesterday threw out was 73% of this farm bill will go towards nutrition programs. That means stocking food banks, food stamps, as Dan mentioned, school lunch programs. One key player that, you know, people in New York City might be interested in is Charlie Rangel. He's the head of the Ways and Means Committee, represents Harlem, but he got drawn into the farm debate, and reluctantly so at first, I believe, because he had to help rejigger the budget, essentially, with some tax provisions to help pay for some of these new programs. And he essentially demanded that there be more nutrition funding in there. And so when he did that, he brought along, you know, plenty of urban members who really support, who are more inclined to support a bill that increases nutrition funding and that sort of thing.
My guests are Catherine Richard, the agriculture reporter for the Congressional Quarterly, and Dan Morgan, investigative reporter and editor at the Washington Post. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Dan, in that series that you did for the Washington Post, you went and visited farmers all over the country. Can you describe the kinds of farms you came across?
Well, there are all different kinds of farms out there. And it's a changing picture, too. We went to all kinds of farms. We went to mainly commercial farms that were producing these subsidized crops, because that's what we were writing about. We were writing about farm subsidies. You know, it's helpful to note, I think, that you had mentioned earlier the 1930s. There's a totally different agriculture looks totally different now. And so when I would go out to farm country, it's typical to find a farm of several thousand acres still being run by a family, a man, his son, and his brother, for example. Would be typical. There are now in 2002 there were more than 150,000 farms out there with sales over $250,000, which is not small.
So you report about a single farm that stretched across five states and 13 counties, and suggest that isn't all that uncommon.
Well, I think it is uncommon. I mean, that's an interesting example because it is a little bit untypical. To have something that big,
do they get subsidies?
They do. They do get subsidies.
And how is that justified?
Yeah, well, that's one of the problems. The point I wanted to make was that the subsidies are contributing, it is widely agreed by economists, to a consolidation, the ever-increasing size of farms. They're still family farms, but they're getting bigger and bigger. They're more like businesses. There are 2% of the farms out there now have sales of over $1 million a year. They're farms like the one you just described.
Are they getting the bulk of the money?
They get the bulk of the they do get the larger farms do get the bulk of the subsidies. And the rationale used is that you know, this is America. We shouldn't punish people being successful.
But the whole idea of farm subsidies is to help small farmers and to keep families down on the farm, isn't it?
No. That's not the reason for. I don't think even the strongest advocates of these programs would say that the idea is to help small farms. There really aren't very many small farms out there that are receiving large amounts of subsidies anymore. Farming has become a business. It is a large scale business with a lot of capital involved. Business consultants advising farmers on what to do, and farmers very large investments in equipment and who are using the futures markets and the options markets to hedge their the products they're producing. So I don't think the protection of the small farm is in any way, shape, or form the goal of farm policy.
But, Catherine, if you read the books, the books by Michael Pollan and Alice Waters and many others about what we should be doing right now and in reflected in the slow food movement and the local food movement and all the growth of green markets all over the country, isn't that where we should be going?
I certainly think some people would argue that.
Because monoagriculture has been also seen as having a negative effect on the environment.
Sure, and I think that there's a realization in Congress that those issues exist, and we do need to be putting more money into farmers markets and local markets and that sort of thing. And certainly there is funding in the bill for that. It doesn't stack up against funding for some of the other big ticket items, but it's there. And I think people do realize that this farm bill isn't just about crop subsidies anymore. It's also about, you know, treating the land well and making sure that there are programs in place to do that and recognizing some of the small farmers out there. But you have to understand that the farm lobby in Washington, D.C. is alive and well, you know, and that certainly plays into this debate dramatically every time the farm bill is written.
Were you surprised, Dan, when farmers told you they felt bad about receiving subsidies for no reason?
No, because farmers are hardy breed of individuals who have mixed feelings about this, and when you almost always when you talk to them, they will say, "I'd rather that I didn't have to get anything from the government, but on the other hand, this is a very volatile business," and they're right about that. The problem I think that is emerging here is in this farm debate is not that we shouldn't be providing some kind of a safety net for what is in fact a very risky business and volatile business with a lot of capital tied up in it. The question is more to the what is politically sustainable? Farm income hit a record $92 billion this year. It's $30 billion above the average of the last 30 years, and yet we're going to be paying farmers about $5 billion a year in these income support payments, whether or not prices stay high or not. That is not politically sustainable, as many politicians will admit to you. And so the question is, how do you reshape this thing to accomplish a safety net that isn't wasteful?
Sure.
In your series, you explained how the system works and found tremendously wasteful, spending some $15 billion out of a total of $95 billion over 5 years.
Right.
That's a lot. $15 billion is a lot of money.
Yes, and they're not much of that will change in the new farm bill, I don't think.
Well, we have yet to see whether we'll have a new farm bill. Catherine, you were going to say something. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I guess I just wanted to emphasize the fact that there are certainly members of Congress who are speaking for major changes. You know, I mean, Richard Lugar from Indiana, I mean, he represents a farming state, and Ron Kind from Wisconsin also represents a huge farming state. Have been very involved in the debate this year and have been advocating, I think Lugar's been advocating for decades that we change the system towards more of a free market system that relies more on crop insurance rather than crop subsidies and that sort of thing. So it's not like these arguments aren't happening in Washington. They're certainly there. And I think the administration's initiative back in the beginning of 2007 to release their own farm bill proposal certainly added to that dialogue. They didn't do that in 2002. They certainly weighed in, but they didn't have a comprehensive, you know, essentially a bill that they proposed to Congress. And that's become a major, you know, headline, I guess, in the past couple of weeks as the farm negotiators conference their bill and get ready to send it to the president.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll be taking listener calls and talk about the farm bill that House and Senate negotiators reached final agreement on just yesterday. Our number here is 212-433-9692. And my guests on today's Please Explain, talking about farm subsidies, are Catherine Richard, the agriculture reporter at the Congressional Quarterly, and Dan Morgan, investigative reporter and editor with the Washington Post. Stay with us. Back with Please Explain. Our number here, 212-433-9692, and our guests, Dan Morgan of the Washington Post and Catherine Richard of the Congressional Quarterly. Yesterday, as I said, the House and Senate negotiators reached final agreement on a new farm bill that will cost close to $300 billion over the next 5 years. That's a lot of money. Isn't President Bush expected to veto it?
Yeah, he is. He has said over and over and over again from really the early stages of the debate back in 2007 that he would veto a bill that, you know, didn't trim subsidies substantially, didn't include some of the new programs that he's after, and that sort of thing. And that's not going to change this week. I anticipate that the president will veto the bill, but that said, I believe that both the Senate and the House have the ability to override that veto. The House maybe just barely, but I think they can do it.
Because this is a bill that's popular with both Democrats and Republicans?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think the House of Representatives really is a great place to look if you want to see the politics of farming. There you see Nancy Pelosi supporting the bill a great deal. You see very fiscally conservative Democrats supporting the bill, but on the other hand, you see budget hawk Republicans rejecting the bill. Minority Leader John Boehner said yesterday that he would not support the bill. He didn't support it in 2002 either. And then you see really, really liberal Democrats, people who come from urban areas or not, even saying that they won't support the bill.
And Barbara Boxer, Nancy Pelosi's colleague from California, is opposed because she says it lacks environmental incentives.
Yeah, I think that she had been concerned about some of the payment limits that would be put on people who are entering some land into land easements. Essentially, USDA will pay farmers and other property owners to preserve land, and this bill, I believe, would include some new limits on who could essentially collect that money from the government and how much they could collect at one time. I think she's concerned about that.
Dan, you want to add anything before we go to the calls?
No, just to reiterate that this is an enormous bill. It doesn't just help farmers. I mean, if you're, what's not to like in this? If you're a member of Congress, it's got it is full of things for the dairy industry and the in the Northeast, new money for them. It's even got some money for farmers in Alaska, which there are only several hundred. It has new tax breaks for the timber industry in Arkansas. It's got things for organic farmers. You mentioned earlier the farm to market movement would get. The organic farm movement is behind this bill. So it's very hard to see who's going to override it, a veto.
We'll take some calls. Jeff from Princeton, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I want to ask a question that is not directly related to the farm bill, but is related in terms of climate change. I know there's a lot of talk, and it's included in Lieberman-Warner, that there are opportunities for farmers to participate in the emissions trading markets that are being bandied about. And I want to know if there's been discussion about the politics of this and how it bodes for the future of these subsidy programs.
Well, there's nothing in the farm bill on emissions trading, as far as I know.
Right.
Catherine,
correct me
if I'm wrong. Congress is beginning to work on a big carbon bill. Whether or not they'll get it done this year, I don't know. It probably most likely after the new president's installed. But sure, I mean, I think farmers that I've talked to are very interested in this and thinking that not knowing how it's going to affect them. Certainly the ethanol industry is eyeing this very carefully. The recent energy bill had provisions in it that will require after the first of next year, will require new ethanol plants to show that they have they're having a positive effect on carbon emissions.
A caller wonders about whether subsidies are going to farmers growing corn for ethanol.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're growing corn, you're getting subsidies from the government. And certainly there are incentives in this bill that would target people who are processing corn into ethanol. There's an extension of the ethanol tariff for 2 years in the bill that, you know, basically boosts our market here in the United States. So there's all kinds of perks and incentives for the ethanol market.
So since that corn going into ethanol has driven up the price of other foods that rely on corn and corn itself, are we to some degree subsidizing price increases?
Yeah. I mean, I think that when you subsidize the ethanol industry, you're you are saying, we think ethanol is important for whatever reasons, and we recognize that there's a limited amount of corn that the, you know, for our livestock industry, for our export markets abroad, and for these new ethanol plants. And so, sure, it's going to have an effect on meat prices indirectly, and you're making that choice.
Well, and I think also the other thing you don't hear quite as much about these days is the fact that farmers are savvy business people. I mean, they saw this ethanol boom coming and they cashed in on it early. And what you saw are farmers all over the country who've grown soybeans or wheat traditionally, or even cotton, turn their fields over to corn. So you're seeing corn being grown in the South, where it's never really been grown before in such large quantities. And so what that means is that the price of wheat and all of these other crops has gone up because people just aren't farming as much of it this year and last year.
Jeff, thank you for your call.
Thanks very much.
Now, a listener wrote in saying that there are farms in New Jersey that are no longer operational but get subsidies because they've been grandfathered in. Is that possible?
And you wrote about this.
It is possible because under the Farm Bill, you can these direct payments, which we've talked about earlier in the program, you get, as I said, willy nilly. Even they are based on, they're an income support based on the historical what a farm has historically done. So if you grew, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, were growing barley in New Jersey, you're going to get a payment for barley in New Jersey, whether you're growing that anymore or not.
And you could just be living there or not growing any crops at all.
Correct. You have to keep it. You have to keep it in agri. It has to be. You have to follow certain rules. It has to be environmentally, you know, sound. You can't just let it grow up into a woods.
And you can't start putting a housing development on it.
No, you're not supposed to, although it happens.
Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Ed from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. Could you distinguish between the, I think price supports, they should disappear in high prices, and the direct subsidies? Could you just tell us how much of each, or, you know, how much of each are a part of the subsidies?
Well, I think I looked at some statistics that we used in one of our articles about a year ago, and it looked like in 2006, the government paid out approximately $16 billion in farm subsidies, and we had a hard time breaking that down. Beyond that, direct payments make up about a third of that. But then beyond that, there's essentially three types of subsidies. Direct payments is one of them, and that's a payment that farmers get no matter what.
Per bushel? No,
it's based on what you grow in your acreage, essentially, and it's a complicated formula, but you get it no matter what. And then you also get you're eligible for a countercyclical payment, and these are essentially payments that kick in when the price set when the price of a crop falls below a target set by the government.
That's a price support, I think.
Yes, that's a price support, and then there's a third kind called a loan deficiency payment, and these are essentially payments that farmers get when they borrow money from the government to essentially support the planting of their crop. And that's an even more complicated subsidy to describe. So the second two are really based more on when you harvest, what you're harvesting, and how crop prices are doing. The first one is something you get, you know, kind of irregardless.
The per production or per bushel or with milk per 100, I don't know what they measure milk in, but how common are those? You can have very large producers getting, you know, if they produce a lot, they get a per gallon or per, you know, for milk, per bushel.
Well, I'm not quite as familiar with all of the dairy subsidies. There is one that works very similar to the countercyclical payment I just described, where you get a subsidy from the government when the price of milk drops, and that is a program that smaller dairies and Midwestern dairies are very supportive of, whereas some of the larger dairies.
Although obviously it hasn't done enough to keep dairy farmers going because many of them have dropped out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
My guests are Catherine Richard, agricultural reporter at the Congressional Quarterly, and Dan Morgan of the Washington Post. He was co-author of Harvesting Cash, a year-long investigative series which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in public service journalism in 2007. Our number here is 212-433-9692. If you want to participate in today's Please Explain about farm subsidies. Dan from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon. I, in the global scheme of things and as part of the negotiations sponsored by the World Trade Organization, the comment has often been made that the U.S. pays its farmers a lot of subsidies. The Europeans pay their farmers more. But I was wondering if the guests could comment on how our subsidies affect farmers in the third world who don't get any subsidies and who climatologically are well situated to produce certain crops and yet have to import them.
Well, there have been some recent studies about the impact of the U.S. cotton subsidies on cotton farmers in West Africa, and they have found these are very poor people that are growing cotton there, and they have found that they have documented that there is an impact. It's not enormous, but it's significant. If you don't have, if your income is very small, it's a significant share of that you could better that income by, if you could get higher prices in the world cotton market. But cotton is very heavily subsidized in the United States. And even with the high prices now, I believe that the guaranteed price, we call the target price, is still actually above the market price. So cotton farmers are still getting some of these traditional subsidies, even in this environment of very high prices. And it does have an impact. The Europeans, in fairness to them, have made some steps, major steps, beginning in 2002, to reduce their subsidies, which are still very substantial. But they are right now in the process of perhaps taking further steps in those directions.
Now, there's a major decrease in the production of rice around the world. Will that be impacted at all by this law if it goes through? Does this law encourage more growing of rice in the United States?
You mean the farm bill?
Yes.
No.
Yeah,
it doesn't. I mean, actually, rice production is declining in the United States, partly because, ironically, as we discovered when we went down to Texas, that landowners can actually make a good solid income just by collecting these direct payments. And so rice land is actually disappearing. The people, there's less rice being farmed down there because landlords have calculated they can make more money just collecting these direct payments and not farming the land.
So this sounds counterproductive, actually. It sounds to me like we're often doing things that make it harder to support farm. Well, somebody's getting money, but not necessarily people who are growing the things that we need.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of criticism of the farm bill for that reason. That the farm bill is pretty traditional. It seems a little bit out of step with all the things that are happening, both in terms of rapidly rising prices, the ethanol boom, and all these things. This is pretty much business as usual.
Are people in Manhattan getting money from this farm bill?
Yeah, they are. It's kind of a funny. Funny quirk, and you see it in the D.C. area as well, people with Washington, D.C. addresses getting farm subsidies. There's a very informative database made by the Environmental Working Group, and they essentially collect data on farm subsidies every year, and they have these really cool interactive maps that they have made with Google Earth to show where farm subsidies are being collected, and they've blown up a few, one of D.C., one of Manhattan, one of San Francisco, to show where literally the addresses where these people are getting money. And the quirk there is that these subsidies are going to people who we would call hobby farmers. They're doctors, they're lobbyists, they're lawyers. They're people who essentially live in the city but have plots of land maybe out in the country where they have a few horses and a garden, or, you know, I mean, I don't know what the description would be exactly, but they're still collecting money on those pieces of land where most of their income is coming from an entirely different profession.
And the Queen of England is collecting money from British subsidies.
Well, I guess she needs to buy a couple of Michelangelo drawings. John from Westchester, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, what's up?
For a reason?
Yeah, I have a question on the new farm bill. I know the 2002 farm bill was a big culprit of supporting farms that weren't environmentally sound. I work on an organic farm up in Westchester, and I know it just a lot of the subsidies that were handed out supported farms that, like Riceco land and large industrial farming, that isn't really supported. It's not environmentally or economically feasible without these subsidies.
Yeah, and I think I kind of asked that question before, but is there concern when people write these bills and thinking about the environment?
Well, there's a great deal of concern. This is an interesting question. One of the things that's happening in Europe is that they have something similar to the direct payments that we've been talking about here, but they link them to a farm's environmental efforts. In other words, you don't get the direct payments unless you're meeting certain environmental requirements. That isn't the case with our direct payments. They are unlinked to anything. You just get them based on what you used to produce. Senator Harkin, in this farm bill, has managed to get considerable new money added for a program which will help working farmers meet environmental standards and improve their environmental practices. And so that's a step in that direction, but it doesn't address the problem that the caller raises about being able to get subsidies and at the same time as you're kind of ignoring good environmental practices.
Well, we have very little time, but what has led Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota to say those who say there's no reform here have not read this bill?
Well, I think that he is pointing to what many lawmakers would say were major concessions on the way farm subsidies are structured, as well as pretty substantial boosts to programs that are important to the president as well. So when he says this bill is full of reform, he's talking about new limits on who can collect subsidies. They tried to basically weed out very wealthy farmers who are collecting subsidies and make sure that they couldn't get them anymore. Depending on who you talk to, some people might say it's an ineffective plan. Some people say it's a good idea, and it will work. It will make sure that really, really wealthy farmers aren't getting subsidies.
We have to leave it there. Thank you both so much. Catherine Richard, agricultural reporter at the Congressional Quarterly, and Dan Morgan, investigative reporter and editor at the Washington Post. It's been a real pleasure having you on today's Please Explain.
Thanks.
On Monday's show, Ted Sorensen, one of JFK's most trusted advisors, looks back on their work together. Also, Siri Husvedt's new novel, The Sorrows of an American, Melissa Errico on her new album, Lullabies and Wildflowers, and Matt Taibbi explains why he says America's in the midst of what he calls the Great Derangement. By the way, you can see photos of some of our recent guests, including Cynthia Ozick, Harry Reid, and Yoko Ono on our show page at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Julia Cochran, John Cottrell, and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. Debbie Dartu is at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host, and I want to thank you for listening, and I hope to see you again on Monday.